Guy had a point, even if I didn't want to admit it. With that noose around his neck, I was pretty sure Nicodemus would smirk just as hard at a flamethrower or a giant meat grinder, for that matter. "Actually, you're the one proceeding from a false assumption," Karen countered in that same deathly calm voice, a decidedly odd light in her eyes, still approaching. "You think I'm holding a rocket launcher." And with that, she knocked some kind of concealed cap off the back of the rocket launcher's tube, and from its length withdrew a sword. Check that. She withdrew a sword. It was a Japanese-style katana blade, set into a wooden cane sheath, in the same style as that of the apocryphal Zatoichi. Even as the false rocket launcher casing fell to the ground, the sword's blade sprang free of its sheath, and as it did, Fidelacius, the Sword of Faith, blazed with furious white light. But more important, the presence of the sword suddenly filled the night, a nearly sub-audible thrumming, like the after-vibration of a bass guitar string. It wasn't something that could be heard precisely, or seen, or felt on the skin, but its presence was absolute, unquestionable, filling the sleet-streaked air. It was power, bone-deep, earth-solid, and terrible in its resolution. I think it was that power that wiped the smirk from Nicodemus's face. His eyes widened in dismay, even his shadow abruptly went statue still. Karen's bid to narrow the distance between them as she had been speaking meant that she was only a few strides away. She closed in, her feet sure, barely seeming to touch the icy ground, and he barely lifted his blade to a defensive counter in time. The swords met in a clash of steel and a blaze of furious light, and she carried her momentum into him with a full body check against his center of gravity. "Watch the big guy," I hissed to Butters, and took a step toward Nicodemus and Karen, then froze in place. Nicodemus slipped on the treacherous ground as Karen slammed into him, but he swept a leg back, dropped one knee to the ground, and prevented himself from falling. She pressed her advantage, their swords locked, each blade exerting lethal pressure against the other. I didn't dare intervene. The least slip or mistake in balance from either of them would mean that the two razor-sharp blades would slice like scalpels into unprotected flesh. I watched them strain silently against each other, strength against strength. Karen wasn't relying on upper body strength to get it done. Her arms were locked in tight against her body, her weight and her legs pressing forward against Nicodemus, and her two-handed grip on Fidelacius gave her a significant leverage advantage against his one-handed grip. The edge of her sword pressed closer to his face with each straining heartbeat until a thin, bright ribbon of scarlet appeared on Nicodemus's cheek. He showed her his teeth, and the strain on his arm quivered through his entire body as he pushed the sword back a precious half-inch from his skin. "So," he hissed, "the burnout thinks she has found her new calling." She didn't say anything back. Karen's never been a big one for back-talking the bad guys without a damn good reason. It's not her fault. She's a practical soul. She took a slow, contained breath and kept up the pressure, veering the blades, altering the direction slightly, so that the locked swords began a slow descent toward Nicodemus's throat. "And you think you deserve to join the ranks of real knights of the sword," Nicodemus said, his voice smooth and confident. "You battered, scarred, broken thing. In my centuries, I've learned exactly what is needed in a real knight. You haven't got what it takes, and you know that, or you'd have taken up the sword before now." Her eyes blazed bright blue in her pale, frightened face, and she leaned forward, pressing the sword closer to his neck and the beating artery there. I'd seen how sharp the katana's blade was. It would take a feather's pressure and the movement of a blade of grass to open Nicodemus's neck once that steel reached his skin. "You've never done this before," he said. "Been this close, this tense, this still, not in earnest. Do you know how many times I've talked to novices exactly like you, in situations almost exactly like this? I've forgotten more about real sword fighting than this pale modern world knows. Karen ignored him. She shifted her hips the barest fraction, seeking a slightly different angle of pressure. The blazing sword dipped another fraction of an inch closer.
Dresden, Nicodemus said, I'm giving you ample chance to call off your dog before I put her down.
His eyes flicked to me. End the little doctor and come back to headquarters. There's no reason I should have to kill all three of you. I ground my teeth. Getting myself killed defending Butters was one thing. Taking Karen with me was something else. But I knew her. I knew what choice she would make without needing to talk to her about it. Karen didn't let the monsters take her people either. But there just wasn't a good option open to me. The Junosqua wasn't far from us, and the damn thing was fast. Even if Butters ran for the safety of Michael's place right now, he'd never get there before it caught him. And I couldn't slow the huge thing down with magic, either. I only had one choice.
All right, I croaked. Damn it, all right.
I grabbed Butters and threw him out in front of me, pointing my staff at him and calling forth my will. The runes blazed up with the pale green-white light of the crystals beneath Demon Reach, from whence the wood from the staff had come.
Sorry about this, Butters, I said. Nothing personal.
Nicodemus's eyes widened. Karen's gaze flicked toward me for an instant, disbelieving, and then resolute.
Harry? Butters asked.
Forzare!
I thundered and unleashed a blast of unseen force from the staff. It took Butters full in the chest, hitting him like a charging bull and hurling him through the sleet and over the little white picket fence into the nearest corner of the carpenter's yard. Everything happened in the same instant. Nicodemus's left arm blurred and produced a short-barreled pistol from somewhere on his body. He jammed it into Karen's belly and pulled the trigger half a dozen times. I let out a scream of defiance and drew that monster revolver from my duster, even as the Junosqua came charging toward me. The winter mantle made me faster than I could ever have been on my own, but even so, there was no time for anything but a hip shot. The Junosqua was maybe 3 feet away when the gun went off, thundering like a high-powered rifle. Then the huge creature hit me like a freight train, picking me up in its onslaught like a piece of litter being towed along by the breeze, and carried me across the street and into the side of the neighbor's minivan. Metal crashed and crunched, glass broke, silver lightning ran through my body without causing me any real pain. The carnivore stench of the Junosqua filled my nose. My arms slammed against the vehicle, but I hung onto the pistol, shoved it against the creature's torso, but before I could shoot, it got hold of my wrist, its huge hands wrapping my forearm as if I'd been a toddler, and slammed it against the minivan, pinning the pistol there. Its other hand landed on my head, claws pressing into my skin as the thick fingers tightened on my skull like a nutcracker.
Hold!
I heard Nicodemus shout, his voice sharp. The Junosqua let out a low growl. It had to turn its shoulders and twist at the waist to look back at him, a simian gesture. There was just too much muscle on that huge neck to allow it the full range of motion. As a result, I was able to see past it. Karen, apparently unhurt, still stood, and she had Phidolachius pressed against Nicodemus's throat. I blinked and felt a sudden surge of ferocious pride. She'd beaten him.
I may be no true knight,
Karen snarled into the sudden silence, her voice tight with pain.
But I'm the only one here. Tell the gorilla to let Dresden go, or I take your head off and give the noose back to the church along with your coin.
Nicodemus stared at her for a moment. Then he opened his hands slowly, and the sword and pistol both tumbled to the frozen ground. The sleet rattled down in silence.
I surrender, he said quietly, his voice mocking.
He tilted his head slightly toward Butters.
And I relinquish my claim on the blood of the innocent. Have mercy on me, O knight.
Tell the Janosqua to let him go, Karen said.
Nicodemus held out his hand. The swarming shadows around him abruptly surged, condensed, flooded toward him. They gathered in his palm, and an instant later, a small silver coin gleamed there, marked with a black smudge in the shape of some kind of sigil. Without looking away from Karen, he dropped the coin, and it fell to the icy sidewalk without bouncing, as if it had been made from something far heavier than lead.
Let Dresden go, Karen said.
Nicodemus smiled, still, his eyes and hands steady. He reached up and undid the noose tied about his throat and let it fall to the ground beside the coin. Karen bared her teeth.
Let him go! I'm not going to ask again.
Nicodemus smiled and smiled and said,
Crush his skull. Make it hurt.
The Janosqua turned back toward me, his eyes blazing from back beneath his cavernous brow, and his fingers tightened on my skull. I dropped my staff and tried to reach up to pry his hand off my head, but quickly realized that I was hilariously outclassed in the physical strength department. If I strained with my entire body, I might have a chance against one of the Janosqua's fingers. I tried that. The vice tightened. My breathing turned harsh as red cracks began to spread through the silvery sensation.
But I've surrendered, Nicodemus assured Karen. It's very clear what you must do.
His smile had returned, and his voice dripped contempt.
Save me, O knight.
You son of a bitch, Karen snarled.
Her breath had begun to come in gulps.
You son of a bitch!
Pain finally began to hammer through the mantle of winter. I heard myself make an animal sound as the Janosqua's grip tightened. His breathing was getting faster and harsher, too. He was enjoying this. My groan shook Karen, visibly her body reacting to the sound. I saw it coming, what Nicodemus was doing. I tried to warn her, but as I began to speak, the Janosqua wrapped my head back against the minivan, and nothing came out.
Save me, Nicodemus said again, and watch him die.
Damn you!
Karen snarled. Her hips and shoulders twisted to deliver the lethal slash. The light of the blade died away as abruptly as that of an unplugged lamp. The thrum of power that resonated through the very air vanished. Nicodemus rolled, moving like a snake, anticipating her perfectly and flowing away from the sword with a sinuous motion of spine and shoulder. Karen was thrown slightly off balance by the lack of resistance, and his hands swept up and seized her wrists. The pair of them struggled for a second, and then Phidolochius swept up high over Karen's head. Her expression whitened in horror as she saw the sword, now gleaming with nothing more than ordinary light. Then, guided by Nicodemus's hands, the ancient sword came smashing down onto the concrete of the sidewalk, the flat of the blade striking the frozen stone. It shattered with a rising shriek of protesting metal, shards flickering in the streetlights. Pieces of the blade went spinning in every direction, sparkling reflected light through the darkness. Karen stared at it with unbelieving eyes.
Ah,
Nicodemus said. The wordless sigh was a slow, deep expression of utter satisfaction. Awful silence fell. The sword of faith was no more. Chapter 30. Sleet rattled down. A dog howled somewhere a few blocks away, a lost and lonely sound. Karen's breath exploded from her in a sob, her blue eyes wide and fixed on the shattered pieces of the blade.
Judge not, lest ye be judged, Miss Murphy,
Nicodemus purred, and then he slammed his head into hers. She reeled back from the blow and was brought up short by Nicodemus's grip on her arm.
It is not the place of a knight to decide whether or not to take the life given to another, Nicodemus continued.
Before she could recover, he struck her savagely, the heel of his hand cracking into her jaw with an audible crunching sound.
Not your place to condemn or consign.
Karen seemed to gather herself together. She flicked a quick blow at Nicodemus's face, forcing him to duck. And then their hands engaged in a complex and swift-moving series of motions that ended with Karen's left arm held out straight, while she was forced down to her knees on the freezing sidewalk. I'd never seen her lose when it came to grappling for a lock. Never.
I'm not sure what would have happened if you'd simply struck without that condemnation, Nicodemus continued. But it would seem that in the moment of truth, your intent was not pure.
He twisted his shoulders in a sudden, sharp motion. Karen screamed briefly, breathlessly. I struggled against the Janoskwa's crushing grip. I might as well have been a puppy for all the effect my best efforts had on the thing. I gathered my will and flung a half-formed working of power against him, but again, the energy grounded itself harmlessly into the earth as it struck him. I could do nothing. Nicodemus twisted Karen, tilted his head to one side, and then drove his heel against her knee with crushing strength. I heard bones and tendons parting at the blow. Karen choked out another sound of pain and crumpled to the ground, broken.
I was afraid for a time that you actually would leave the sword out of it, Nicodemus said.
He bent and recovered the noose calmly, fastening it around his neck as casually as a businessman putting on his tie.
Survivors of Chichen Itza, and there were more than a few, in part thanks to your efforts, describe your contribution to that conflict as impressive. You were obviously ready and in the right that night, but you were never meant for more. Most Knights of the Cross serve for less than 3 days, did you know that? They aren't always killed. They simply fulfill their purpose and go their way.
He leaned down closer to her and said,
You should have had the grace to do the same. What drove you to take up the sword when you knew you weren't worthy to bear it? Was it pride?
Karen shot him a fierce glare through eyes hazed with pain and tears, and then looked over at me. He straightened, arching an eyebrow.
Aha! Of course,
he said, his tone dry, yet somehow filled with venomous undertones.
Love.
Nicodemus shook his head and picked up his sword with one hand and the coin with the other.
Love will be the downfall of God himself.
Karen snarled weakly and flung the broken hilt of Phidolachius at Nicodemus's head. He snapped his sword up, flicking it contemptuously away from him. The wooden handle landed in the carpenter's yard. Nicodemus stepped closer to Karen, dropping the point of his sword again, aiming it at her. As he did, blackness slithered down his body again onto the ground, his shadow spreading out around him like a stain of oil over pure water. Karen fumbled backward, away from him, but she could barely move with only one arm and one leg functioning. The wet sleet plastered her hair to her head, made her ears stick out, made her look smaller and younger. I kicked at the Janoskwa through the red haze over my vision. With winter upon me, I can kick cinder blocks to gravel without thinking twice. It was useless. He was all mass and muscle and rock-hard hide.
Face it, Miss Murphy, Nicodemus said, keeping pace with her.
His shadow swarmed all over the ground around her, surrounding her.
Your heart,
the tip of his sword dipped toward it by way of illustration,
simply wasn't in the right place.
He paused there long enough to give her time to see the sword thrust coming. She faced him, her eyes fierce and frightened, her face pale with pain. And the front door of the carpenter's house opened. Nicodemus's dark eyes flickered up at once and stayed focused on the front porch. Michael stood in the doorway to the house for a brief moment, leaning on his cane, surveying the scene. Then he limped down the steps and out onto the walk leading from the front porch to the mailbox. He moved carefully and steadily in the sleet, right up to the gate in the white picket fence. He stopped there, maybe 3 feet from Nicodemus, regarding him steadily. Sleet struck and melted into rain on his flannel shirt. "Let them go," Michael said quietly. Nicodemus's mouth turned up at one corner. His dark eyes shone with a dangerous light.
"You have no power here, Carpenter. Not any longer."
"I know," Michael said. "But you're going to let them go."
"And why should I do that?"
"Because if you do," Michael said, "I'll walk out this gate." Even where I was, I could almost see the blaze of hatred that flared out of Nicodemus's eyes. His shadow went insane, flickering from side to side, surging up the white picket fence like an incoming tide chewing at a stone cliff.
"Freely?" Nicodemus demanded. "Of your own choice and will?"
A critical point. If Michael willingly divested himself of angelic protection, there would be nothing his bodyguards could do. Angels have terrible power, but not over free will. Michael would be helpless, just like Shiro had been helpless.
"Michael!"
I grated. I was under some pressure. I sprayed a lot more spittle than I thought I would.
"Don't do it!"
Michael gave me a small smile and said chidingly,
"Harry."
"There's no point," Karen gasped, her voice thin and breathless, "in you dying too. He'll just come after us again later."
"You'd both do the same for me," Michael said, and looked up at Nicodemus with that same quiet smile. And then the sleet just stopped. I don't mean it stopped sleeting. I mean that the sleet stopped moving. The half-frozen droplets hung in the air, suspended like millions of tiny jewels. The slight wind vanished. The howling dog's voice cut off as abruptly as if someone had flipped a switch. At the same time, a man appeared outside the little gate. He was tall and lean with youth, broad-shouldered like a professional swimmer. His features were porcelain fine. His hair was glossy black and curling, his skin a rich and dark caramel color, and his eyes glittered silver green. There was no fanfare about his appearance. One moment nothing was there, and the next moment he was. His presence was as absolute as it was abrupt, as if the light of the street somehow picked him out more clearly, more sharply than anyone else there. Even if the abrupt cessation of movement in the physical world hadn't been enough to tip me off, I could feel the power in him, radiating from him like light from a star. He'd appeared to me in many different forms, but there was no possibility of mistaking his presence, his identity. Mr. Sunshine, the Archangel Uriel. His gaze was focused exclusively on Michael, and his expression was anguished. "You need not do this," he said, his voice low, urgent. "You have given enough, and more than enough already."
"Uriel," Michael said, nodding his head deeply. "I know."
The angel held up his hand.
"If you do this, I can take no action to protect you," he said. "And this creature will be free to inflict upon you such pain as even you could not imagine."
A sudden sunny smile lit Michael's face.
"My friend."
Uriel blinked and rocked slightly as if the words had struck him with physical force.
"Thank you," Michael continued. "But I'm not the carpenter who set the standard."
Nicodemus tapped Uriel on the shoulder.
"Excuse me."
The angel turned to him slowly. His face was resolute, his eyes flat.
"You're standing in the way of mortal business, angel," Nicodemus said. "Stand aside."
Uriel's eyes flickered, and frozen lightning exploded through the clouds overhead, thunder making the standstill sleet drops quiver.
"You make threats?" Nicodemus asked,
contempt dripping from his voice like blood from a wound.
"Perhaps you should cut your losses. You are without power in this matter, Angel, and we both know it. You can do nothing to me.
And then Nicodemus lifted his left hand and deliberately, calmly, tensed his forefinger beneath his thumb and flicked it out to tap the end of the angel's nose. Uriel's eyes widened, and terrible light gathered around his head and shoulders. Looking at it hurt, burned the eyes, seared my mind with sudden memories of every shameful act I'd ever chosen to do, scorched me with the obvious truth of how easy it might have been to make a different choice. The light of Uriel's halo banished shadows and averted everyone's gaze. Everyone but Nicodemus.
"Go on, Angel," Nicodemus taunted, his shadow swelling and curling in slow, restless motion. "Smite me. Visit your wrath upon me. Judge me."
Uriel stared at him. Then the angel's gaze went to the shards of Phidolachius. He closed his eyes for a moment and turned his face away from the Denarian. The light of his halo flickered and died away. A tear slid down his cheek. And he stepped aside and began walking away.
"Dude!"
I said in protest. It was getting hard to see through all the red.
"What the hell kind of angelic protector are you? Do something!"
Uriel did not look back.
"Now, then," Nicodemus said to Michael.
His sword had never ceased pointing at Karen's heart.
"If I release this pair, you will step through that gate?"
Michael nodded once. "I will. You have my word." Nicodemus's eyes glittered. He looked up at the Genosqua and nodded, and suddenly I was on the ground, untouched, with the giant thing looming over me. The shaggy, hulking creature stared at Uriel with hateful eyes. But then that feral gaze flickered up to the house and around the yard, skipping from point to point and looking at something that I couldn't see. The blood rushed back and forth through my head, pounding hard, and though winter held the pain at bay, my vision pulsed darker and lighter with every heartbeat.
"Go on, Dresden," Nicodemus said. "Take her inside."
It took me a couple of tries to get to my feet, but I did it. Stuffed my revolver back into my duster's pocket, and shambled over to Karen. She was in bad shape, obviously in severe pain. When I picked her up, she would have screamed if she'd had the breath. Michael opened the gate for me, and I carried her through it, into the yard, then put her down as carefully as I could on the grass. Uriel, meanwhile, had gone to Butters's side. He crouched down and shook him. Butters started awake and sat up, rubbing at his head. Uriel spoke to him in a low, intent voice, nodding toward the house. Butters swallowed, his eyes the size of teacups, and nodded. Then he got up and half ran around the house into the backyard. Uriel gave me an intent look.
"Time," said a voice in my head. "Get me a little time."
"I've kept my word," Nicodemus said to Michael. "Now, it's your turn."
"The hell you have," I spat. "You just ordered your goon to kill me. You've broken your contract with Mab."
Nicodemus shifted his gaze to me and looked amused.
"That?" he said. "Goodness, Dresden. Can you not recognize a ploy when you see one?"
"What ploy?" I demanded.
"I needed to put a little pressure on Miss Murphy," he said. "But you were never in any actual danger. Do you honestly think it would take the Genosqua more than a few seconds to crack even a skull so thick as yours?"
He smiled widely, clearly enjoying himself.
"Why, it was no more an attempt to kill you than was your participation in the chase of the little doctor, a betrayal of Mab's word that you would aid me."
Damn it. Nothing like a little pro forma quid pro quo action. By Mab's reckoning, I was pretty sure Nicodemus and I had played this one out evenly. My actions in protecting Butters could be explained as bad luck and sincere incompetence. Nicodemus's attempt to kill me could be explained as a ploy to destroy the sword. His eyes narrowed.
And I fully expect you to continue to fulfill your half of the bargain, Dresden, regardless of what happens over the next few hours.
I ground my teeth and said, You attacked Murphy.
I warned you that I could not guarantee her safety, he said in a reasonable tone. And in any case, she initiated the attack, if you recall. And she's not dead just yet.
He showed me white teeth.
I'd say that I'm being more than reasonable, and so would your liege.
Again, he was right. By Mab's reckoning, he was indeed a reasonable man. Uriel, meanwhile, had paced over to stand at Michael's right hand. I took up station on my friend's left.
The bargain was made, Nicodemus purred to Uriel. His word freely given. You cannot stop him from fulfilling it.
Correct, Uriel said. But I can help him do so.
Nicodemus's smile slipped. Calmly, Uriel turned to Michael. He put a hand on Michael's shoulder and gently took his cane away. Michael blinked at Uriel, his arms going out for balance, his body tightening as if he expected to pitch over without the cane's support. And then he abruptly relaxed. He put some of his weight on his bad leg, and then a little more. And then he let out a little laugh and hopped on it a few times. Just then, Butters came running back around from behind the house. There was a twig with a soggy brown oak leaf still attached to it in his hair. His knees were scuffed and marked with sap, and he was carrying a slender package wrapped in canvas and duct tape, almost as long as he was tall. Butters was tearing at the package as he ran over and then offered it to Michael. Michael's eyes widened and went to Nicodemus as he stretched out his right hand without looking, without needing to look, and withdrew from the canvas package a sword, a shining length of straight steel with a cruciform hilt. As Michael's fingers closed on it, Amorakius exploded into white light. And for the second time in an evening, the quiet, ominous power of one of the swords filled the air. Nicodemus's eyes widened.
You cheat, he snarled.
I said I would come out to you, Michael said.
Then he lifted a work-booted foot and kicked the white picket gate off its hinges. It struck Nicodemus across the torso, driving him back into the street, and Michael Carpenter, Knight of the Cross, strode out of the open gate onto the icy sidewalk while the archangel looked on, silver-green eyes blazing in answer to the light of the sword in Michael's hands.
I'm out, Michael said. In nomine Dei, Nicodemus, I have come to face you.
In the street, Nicodemus bared his teeth. I was terrified for Michael, and my heart soared.
Ha ha!
I said, like the bully on The Simpsons, pointing at him. Then I walked out of the gate to stand beside my friend. I pointed my finger at my quarterstaff fallen on the ground where the Genoscoi had held me, exerted my will, and called, Ventus Servitus! A burst of wind rose and flung the staff into the air. I caught it and called power into it, summoning green-white light and silvery soul fire into the channels of power that ran through its runes. Uriel smiled tightly, his eyes hard, and the sleet began to fall once more. It burst into little drops of steam when it hit the runes on my staff.
Two of you, I said to Nicodemus. Two of us. What do you think, Nick?
Michael faced him squarely, both hands on the hilt of Amorakius. The sword's light filled the air, and Nicodemus's shadow quailed before it. Nicodemus finally stood back. He lowered his blade and said,
Dresden, I expect you back at our headquarters by 4 a.m.
He turned to go.
Not so fast, smart guy, I said.
Nicodemus paused.
If I have to play by these stupid rules, so do you. I still get someone to watch my back during this job.
Miss Murphy is more than welcome to do so.
You put her out of commission, I said. You didn't have to do that. You'd already beaten her.
Then choose another, Nicodemus snapped.
I put a hand on Michael's shoulder and said, I already have, and you're going to put up with it, or I'll consider it a release of obligation, and so will Mab. Nicodemus simply stood, soaked by the sleet and unmoved by the cold. He stared at me in chilly silence for several seconds, then he said, So be it. Shadows gathered around him and vanished up into the stormy night, taking him with them. I looked left and right and realized that the Janosqua was already gone. Michael was looking at me very oddly as he lowered the sword. What? I asked him. Charity, he predicted, is not going to be pleased. Chapter 31. Once Nick and Big Shaggy were gone, I hurried to Karen. She was on her back, shuddering, her eyes focused on nothing. I turned to Uriel, pointed a finger at Karen, and said, Fix her. Uriel grimaced. I cannot. After a moment, he added, I'm sorry. I'm badly disappointed in you, Mr. Sunshine, I said. Butters? Yeah, yeah, Butters said, already on his way to Karen. Jesus, he said after a moment. Come on, we have to get her out of the cold and wet, like right now. She could be going into shock. I've got a fire going, Michael said. We'll pull the couch up next to it. I stripped out of my coat and put it on the ground next to her. We lifted her onto it. Hey, Mr. Sunshine, I said, maybe a little more harshly than I could have. Some cosmic limitation that keeps you from picking up your corner of the coat? Uriel blinked, but then hurried over to us and took one side of the coat willingly. We all picked up the coat with Karen on it, trying to support her evenly. She made an incoherent sound of pain as we did. We carried her into the house together, with Butters opening doors for us. Michael watched my face closely as we carried her. What? I asked. You aren't angry, he said, that she's hurt. Like hell I'm not, I said. It's coming. After we take care of her, when it's time. Michael grunted. You aren't more angry than you would be if it was me or Butters here. I grunted. She's not a delicate princess, I said. She's a warrior. Warriors have enemies. Sometimes warriors get hurt. I felt my jaws clench. And then their friends even things up. Damn right they do, Butters said. Michael's eyes were steady. Harry... We'd gotten Karen into Michael's living room by then and settled her slowly onto the couch. Good to his word, there was a fire burning in a neat stone fireplace inside. Once she was on the couch, I picked up one end, Uriel picked up the other, and we set the whole thing down in front of the fireplace, where the heat of it would surround her. Towels, Butters said. Blankets, hurry. I'll get them, Uriel volunteered. He turned, paused, and then asked Michael, Where are they? Michael directed him to the linen closet. He hurried off and returned a moment later, arms loaded with cloth. Good, Butters said and seized them. He started taking them to Karen, drying her off. The heat and the chafing of the towels seemed to rouse her slightly, and she blinked her eyes several times. Michael, she said. Michael? I'm here, Michael said. Karen looked up, her face drawn, her eyes full of tears.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I lost the sword.
Easy, Michael said gently. We'll deal with it. You don't have to worry about it right now.
We've got to get the wet clothes off, Butters said. Do you have safety scissors?
In my kit, Michael said. In the kitchen. Uriel said, I'll get it. He walked out and in and passed the same red plastic toolbox Michael had used on me earlier to Butters.
Sorry, Karen, Butters said, about your jacket.
He went to work with the safety scissors, cutting Karen out of her coat while trying not to move her arm and shoulder. She grunted with pain anyway.
I didn't know what to do, Karen said. If I turned from him, he'd have come at my back. If I didn't go to Harry, he was going to die.
Her eyes widened.
Harry, is he?
Here, I said. I found her right hand with mine. Her eyes rolled to me, and her fingers suddenly squeezed down tight on mine. Her hand was icy cold, and she was shivering harder.
Harry, she said, thank God.
Holy crap, Butters said. There are bullet holes in her shirt.
I blew it, Harry, she said. Damn it, I blew it.
She was weeping openly now.
They're always too strong. There's always more of them, and they're always too strong.
Karen, I said. I took her face in my hands and made her look at me as Butters cut away at her shirt. Shut up. You screwed up excellently, okay? We all made it out. We're all gonna be fine. Right, Butters? Butters gave me a tight look.
But the sword, Karen said.
Michael leaned down and said, Have faith, Ms. Murphy, he said, his voice serious. Things are not always as bad as they seem. Sometimes the darkness only makes it easier to see the light. I looked up at Uriel, who compressed his lips into a grim line. Oh, thank God, Butters breathed. She was wearing a vest. Of course I was wearing a vest, Karen said, her voice for a second perfectly clear and slightly annoyed. She was shivering harder now.
Oh, God, cold.
Butters plucked at several small, bright bits of metal, passing them to Michael.
4, 5, how many shots did she take?
5,
Uriel supplied instantly. 22s, Michael said, maybe 25s.
No blood, Butters reported. I think the vest stopped them all.
He kept cutting her shirt away until he could see her injured shoulder. It was already swelling.
We've got to get the vest off of her.
Why? I asked.
Because Kevlar doesn't stretch and she's going to keep swelling. And because this needs a hospital. I'd rather she didn't have to answer any questions about a damaged bulletproof vest once we get there.
It might not be safe, I said. Why can't you take care of her here?
Because I don't have the tools I need to help her here. And I don't have the expertise to use them, even if I did.
Butters said, his voice hard.
Look, Harry, not everyone has got your ability to handle injury. Her shoulder is dislocated, and there's probably additional damage. I haven't seen her knee yet, but from the shape of it, I think he took her ACL. This isn't something she can just walk off, and if she doesn't get proper care fast, it could cripple her for life. So as soon as I'm sure she isn't going into hypothermia, we're going to the hospital.
He looked up at me, his eyes steady, his expression resolute.
And if you argue with me, I'm going to call her friends on the force and tell them that she needs help.
Rage made my vision pulse, and I snarled and clenched my hand into a fist. But Butters didn't back down. Harry, Michael said. He stepped in between us and put a hand on my chest. She can't stay here. She's in agony. I blinked several times and did math, pushing the winter aggression further from my thoughts. The rage receded, leaving weariness behind, and my head started to hurt. Right, I said. Right. Sorry, Butters.
Hey, Mr. Sunshine, you can put a protective detail on her, can't you?
I cannot, Uriel said. So useless, I muttered. The throbbing got worse despite Mab's earring. God, my head.
Michael's restraining hand became a steadying one, his voice sharpening with concern.
Harry, are you all right?
We'll be. Just need a minute to rest.
Uriel, Michael said, his voice softly urgent. The room tilted to one side unexpectedly, and I flailed my arms to try to catch my balance. Michael caught my right arm. Uriel's nose caught my left, right in the aluminum brace, but the Archangel managed to support me. Between the three of us, I found a chair and sat there in it for a minute while my head spun briefly. Uriel had a shocked, even startled look on his face, and his nose was bleeding.
I was pretty sure that wasn't possible. Uriel touched his fingers to his face and drew them away, bright with scarlet blood. He blinked at them, the expression almost childlike in its confusion. Tears welled in his eyes, and he blinked them several times, as if he wasn't sure what was happening. Michael caught the direction of my stare, and his clear gray eyes widened. He straightened, staring at Uriel in shock.
What have you done? He asked.
It was not within our power to heal what was done to you, Uriel said. I'm sorry. It was not chance that brought you to harm, but choice.
Michael looked from the angel down to his leg and back. What have you done? He repeated. Uriel looked from his shaking, bloodied fingers to Michael and said,
I have loaned you my grace.
Michael's eyes became completely round.
Wow, I said. Isn't that kind of important? It is what makes me an angel, Uriel said.
Merciful Mother of God, Michael said, his voice awed.
I said, isn't that kind of overkill? I mean, Uriel, you've got the power to unmake solar systems.
Galaxies, Uriel said absently. Harry, Michael said, what are you saying?
Why? I asked Uriel. I had to do something, he said. I couldn't just stand there, but my options are limited.
Oh, I said, I get it, I think.
Harry, Michael said, what are you talking about?
I said and rubbed at my aching head. Uriel wanted to help you, but he couldn't exert his will over the situation to change it, right?
Correct, Uriel said.
But he could act in accordance with your will, Michael, which was to go out and meet Nicodemus.
Yes, Michael said.
So he couldn't change you, I said, and he couldn't change the world around you, at least not of his own will, but he could change himself. So he gave you his power in order to make your body function the way it used to. That way, it isn't his will that's using the power, it's yours. The throbbing had begun to recede slowly, and I looked up. It's way more than you needed, but it's the only unit he had to work with. It's as if he loaned you his giant passenger jet because you needed a reading light, I eyed the angel. Right? Uriel nodded and said, close enough. Michael opened his mouth in understanding. Loaned, he said. It won't last. Uriel shook his head. But this task is an important one. You need it. Use it.
Michael tilted his head.
But, Uriel, if I were to misuse it, I would fall, Uriel said quietly. I choked on the air. Holy crap. The last time an archangel fell, I'm pretty sure there were extended consequences. Uriel smiled faintly at Michael.
I'm confident that you won't.
His smile turned a little green.
I would, however, appreciate it if you did not push any buttons or pull any of the levers in my giant passenger jet.
How could you do this? Michael breathed.
You need the reading light, Uriel said. You have more than earned whatever help I can give. And you are a friend, Michael.
What happens to you while I borrow your jet? Michael asked.
Transubstantiation, Uriel said.
He gestured with his bloodied fingers. Butters finally chimed in.
Holy crap. He's mortal?
And he can die, I said quietly. Chapter 32. The fire crackled.
Because, obviously, I said, there wasn't enough on the line already.
Uriel smiled. It was a tight, pained expression. Take it back, Michael said. You've got to take it back right now.
I can do that, Uriel said. If that is your choice, I will respect it.
Something in his voice triggered my instincts, and I said, Michael, wait, think about this.
What's to think about? Michael asked.
An archangel of the Lord is vulnerable.
Right, I said and spread my hands. Almost as if he thinks this is important or something.
Or maybe you figure Uriel for the kind of guy who hands out this kind of power all willy-nilly every time the wind blows. I looked at Uriel.
Right?
Uriel helped Butters get another blanket around the shuddering Karen, watched us, and said nothing. Yeah, I said. You can tell when you're on the right track because he shuts up and doesn't tell you a damn thing.
It's about the Grail, isn't it? About what Nicodemus wants to do with it.
Uriel gave me a knowing look. I flushed and said, I'm playing my cards close to the chest, okay? I know it's about more than that. He put his hand on Karen's head and smiled at her encouragingly. Michael shook his head and walked over to where he'd set Amarakius after he'd drawn it from his belt once we had Karen inside. He picked it up absently and started cleaning water from it carefully with one of the used towels. You're asking me to make a very large choice. Yes, Uriel said, with potentially horrible consequences. Uriel looked at him with sympathetic eyes and nodded. Can you tell me what is at stake that I should risk this? Uriel frowned, considering the question for a moment, then he said,
A soul.
Michael raised his eyebrows. Oh, he said. You should have said that from the beginning. He extended the sword and looked down the length of its blade. I'm not retired at the moment, he said. What about my family?
The guards remain, Uriel said. I have taken your place.
Michael exhaled and some of the tension eased out of him. Right, though this is going to draw attention here again.
It might.
And your protection doesn't extend to the merely mortal, Michael said.
No.
So mortals could enter and kill you, kill them.
Potentially, he said.
Guys, Butter said, we need to get her to a hospital.
Right, I said, here's the plan. Butters drives Murphy to the hospital and tells the guys at SI she needs looking after.
Those guys can't stop someone like Nicodemus, Butters said.
No, I said, but they can force him to get noisy if he wants to get to her, and Nick won't want that until after the job. He might send some of his squires to do it, but SI can go up against them just fine. Michael, will you loan Butters a car?
Of course, Michael said.
Good. They'll help you unload her at the emergency room, Butters.
Right, Butters said. Great.
I'm going to go clean up out front, I said. What's left of the sword, shell casings, what have you. Those shots were muffled by the sleet, but we don't need to leave things lying around in case some busybody called the cops.
Leaving me to talk to Charity alone, Michael said dryly.
Yeah, funny how that worked out, I said.
Where is she, anyway?
In the panic room with Mouse and the kids, Michael said. Little Harry was all but bouncing off the walls, he was so excited. I didn't want him seeing... He nodded toward Karen. I'll sound the all clear as soon as she and Butters leave.
Good call, I said.
What should I do?
Uriel asked. Sit, I said. Stay inside. Don't put pennies in the outlets or play with matches or run with scissors.
I don't understand, Uriel said.
Take no chances, I clarified.
Oh, yes.
He frowned and said,
But I want to help.
So sit, I said. Sitting quietly is very helpful. He sat down on the arm of the couch, frowning.
I think this will hurt the least if one person carries her, Butters said.
Right, I said, rising, and wobbled as the blood rushed to my head. Harry, Michael said, and pushed gently in front of me. He went over to Karen, adjusted the couch to give him room to stand in front of her. He passed Butters a set of car keys.
It's her left arm and leg that are hurt, Butters said. Carry her right side against you and try to support her left knee.
I'll be careful, Michael said, and lifted her gently, keeping her wrapped in the blankets. He didn't seem to have any trouble doing it. I mean, he didn't look like he'd gained muscle or anything, but his strength was certainly that of the night I remembered, and not of the lame contractor and Little League softball coach he'd been lately. Karen let out a soft sound of pain and closed her eyes, breathing with steady, disciplined rhythm through her nose.
Right, right, Butters said.
He'd discarded his pack before, but he recovered it now, as we went outside and loaded Karen into Michael's white pickup truck. We got her in and buckled up, though she was obviously fighting the pain. Michael hurried back inside, out of the sleet. She opened her eyes once and gave me a little smile.
Sorry, she said. That I won't be there to watch your back.
You did fine, I said. We'll make sure you've got cover.
Worry about yourselves, she said.
I can make some calls. Michael's a good man, but he doesn't always see things coming.
I bit my lip for a second, trying to decide if I should say anything. I decided not to. If she didn't know what was coming up, she couldn't possibly tip off anyone that I already knew part of what Nicodemus was up to. I need to work on my poker face. She looked at my expression and smiled with one side of her mouth.
Need to know. I get it, Harry.
She struggled to free her right hand from the blankets so that she could put it on mine and squeeze.
Make the sucker punch count.
I winked at her. I'll come see you soon.
You'd better, she said.
Butters slammed the driver's side door and brought the truck to life with a smooth rumble of V8 engine. He turned the heaters all the way up first thing and double-checked Karen's seatbelt. Then he adjusted the mirrors, muttered something about the truck being the size of a house, and said to me, "Close it up. I'll get you word as soon as I know anything." I nodded and said, "Thanks, Butters." He grimaced and said, "Thank me when I save your life." "You've done that already," I said, "back in the museum." "So we're even?" "Once you've made that swap, you don't keep counting, man," I said. "Drive safe." I closed the door carefully and watched Butters back the truck out onto the icy street. He put it into the lowest gear and the tires crunched slowly down the street as he drove away. He'd been out of the driveway for maybe 20 seconds when a flickering stream of campfire sparks came soaring down out of a nearby tree and through the windshield of the truck. Bob returning to the skull, still in Butters' backpack. I watched until they were gone. Then I hurriedly cleaned up the scene, fake rocket launcher, sword shards, sheath, hilt, and shell casings all, and hurried back inside. I shut the door behind me and leaned against it. For a second, I was alone. I missed Karen already. Logically, I knew that she probably wasn't in any immediate danger from Nicodemus and company, but some irrational part of me wanted to be the one who drove her to the hospital, terrified the doctors into perfection, and watched over her when she could finally sleep. She'd looked so small like that, with her wet hair plastered down, swaddled in blankets. And she wouldn't have been that way if I hadn't invited her along for the ride. I mean, yeah, logically, I hadn't been the one to hurt her. Nicodemus had done that. But there was a great, seething tide of anger somewhere behind the walls of my mind. Absolute fury that she had come to harm. And since it had no handy targets to crash upon, some stupid part of my brain had decided that I would do. And now I was going to drag Michael into my mess as well. And if he got put in a compromising position the way Karen had, the consequences might be significantly more severe. And all because I'd been weak and cut a deal with Mab. I gritted my teeth and forced myself to stand on my own 2 feet again. What was done was done. There was no point in tearing myself to shreds over it, especially since indulging in that kind of self-flagellation would not help me protect Michael or stop Nicodemus from obtaining one of the most powerful holy relics in the world. There would be plenty of time to beat myself up later, assuming I lived long enough to do it. Focus on the task at hand, Harry. Sort the rest out when you have time. Yeah, sure. But isn't that the kind of thinking that got me into this mess in the first place? I was trying to learn to play the game a few more moves ahead than I had in the past. Part of that had been keeping Karen in the dark about what I had in mind for Nicodemus and company. But man, that game was hard to play. Bleak thoughts. I was roused from them by feet on the stairs. I looked up. At the top of the stairs stood two figures, an enormous dog and a little girl. The dog was gray, shaggy, in the size of a bantha. A bulky ruff of fur about his head and shoulders gave him a leonine look, and his dark eyes were bright, his slightly curled tail wagging so furiously that it looked like it might pull him over sideways. When Mouse saw me, he made a happy little chuffing sound, and his front paws bounced off the floor, but then he glanced to the girl beside him and held himself carefully still. The little girl stood with her hands buried in the thick fur of Mouse's mane, as though she had refused to admit that she couldn't just circle her arms around his neck and tote him about like a teddy bear. She was wearing an old T-shirt of Molly's that read SplatterCon across the front. The shirt hung past her knees, and its sleeves went halfway to her wrists. She had big brown eyes, the size of softballs, it looked like, and her dark brown hair hung straight down to her little shoulders. Her features were a little long. I could see myself in the shape of her eyes, in the set of her chin.